This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
We are talking this morning to Santharuban Turesundaram, the chief executive of the halal beverage company Eteco Group, formerly known as Permanis and today a subsidiary of Asahi, the Japanese brewing conglomerate. Ruben, now I understand the company became part of Japan's Asahi Group from 2014, and today your role, the country's market, plugs into Asahi Southeast Asia, the non-alcohol segment of Asahi's business. The idea, of course, is to plug into ASEAN's 600 million plus people and its huge and growing consumer market. So I guess, yeah, if you can start by explaining the strategy, the Southeast Asia strategy of Malaysia being the cash cow and moving to the market from there.
Yeah, so as you very aptly put it, we were acquired by Asahi some years back. And so part of the acquisition was two companies. So we were known as Permanis back then, which we were largely the franchisee of PepsiCo. And then there was an acquisition of another company called Etika. Etika came along together with a few brands, Daily Chan, condensed milk, as well as Lutte milk. And sometime back in 2016, we merged both these organizations and called ourselves Etika. Now, as part of the acquisition of Etika, we had footprints in Vietnam, Indonesia, and a huge export business centered in Malaysia. Now, in a typical manufacturing business, it is very crucial to have a strong manufacturing footprint, and Permanis brought that to the table. So Asahi has then used or based our entire business in Malaysia for Southeast Asia for those reasons.
Yeah, so Malaysia is the cash cow for ASEAN, which is interesting because ASEAN is at least 12 or 13 countries, depending how big your footprint is. Why is it that, you know, Malaysia is known as the cash cow? What is the largest strategy? I think there's a move towards premiumization as well. Can you talk through those ideas?
So a couple of things. I think one of the reasons why it was positioned that way is because our manufacturing footprint and business is already based here. So that's the first thing. And of course, moving into other markets, strong intake markets like Indonesia, where logistics could be a nightmare, Indonesia, Philippines, you have all these other issues that Malaysia don't have, given how they're structured geographically. As far as premiumization is concerned, that's really where beverage sector actually is moving. You see more and more niche beverage today available in chillers, in our convenience stores, that's actually citing towards consumer preference. Consumers today want something that is, I would say, personalized, and they want choices, variety. And being part of a beverage business, both these things actually goes away from what our manufacturing capabilities are. So we've got to produce in mass, and we are, in most cases, unable to produce something that's actually personalized. So moving forward as a business, is how do we crack these two factors in order for us to command a more premium price on our offering. So that's one. Secondly, it's also moving into categories that are more premium and better for you. As we know, non-dairy segments are essentially growing, is booming. You see a rise of kombucha. So there are more and more categories that are we're not necessarily participating in today. That's premium, and it's what consumers want.
Exactly, and you're trying to move away also from, I guess reducing the dependence on condensed milk, which is clearly quite sweet, and we'll get into those ideas in a little while, Ruben. But I want to talk about numbers, and obviously Asahi, your parent, is the listed company in Japan, and it's they do talk to the investors quite a lot, and according to one of their latest reports to investors and their presentation, it shows that there was expectations of a 0.8% top-line growth for the Southeast Asia market in general, with a core operating profit of just about 0.2 billion yen on a year-on-year basis increase. But you missed on both fronts, both in the top line as well as at operating level. I think distribution channels were said to be a key challenge. Of course, as you say, the challenge of launching premium brands into a cost-conscious market post-pandemic future is another issue. Can you just talk through the challenges of those issues, Ruben?
I think so. There's a couple of things that happened right over the last 2 years, and the pandemic was one of it. And this has seen a few drastic shifts in consumer, in where consumer buy their products. So that's one. go-to-market has been a little bit of a challenge at the same time. And just simply operating was a huge challenge, especially when the pandemic first started 2 years ago. Now, given all these circumstances, we've taken, of course, quite a, and as you've put it earlier, we've taken quite a hit both on top line and bottom line. But as an organization, we've sort of remained resilient. We found ways around it. And I don't think it's just us, but almost most organizations globally has had to find a way to actually reinvent themselves and work within the limitations that the situation has then came with. Now, minus this factor, notwithstanding the fact that we've actually seen increases in commodity prices, right? You've seen, now even recently, you've seen increase in palm oil prices, there's increase in aluminium prices, there's increase in, so most commodities, as commodity prices begin to soar, it begins to shave off our margins more and more.
Yeah, Ruben, the thing is, despite these challenges, it appears that top management and the board of directors won big things from you because they have forecast and I think put on your collective heads a target of a 18% on-year increase in supply and revenue to 7.7 billion yen and a core operating profit increase of 289% of about, in fact, 1.6 billion yen forecast for you guys. Those are big, very stretched targets. The fact that you're quite new into the role as a marketing man, does that point towards the strategy? It was more of a marketing campaign to bring those brands to market from an awareness perspective.
So let me just break your question in a few. So number one, marketing alone is not going to cut it. I mean, of course, it's cost of marketing, as you know, is actually going higher and higher, given expensive it's become to actually capture consumers' eyeball and attention. It's got to do with a mix of a few things. Now, marketing is, of course, one part of it, to increase our brand preference and steal a portion of the consumer's mind, the share of mind, as I would call it. But secondly, we've got to actually reinvent the way we look at the business. Now, how we go about our distribution, there's a lot of costs there, our cost to serve. So how do we look into our cost to serve? How do we look into our cost to manufacture? And how do we look into our entire GTM strategy as a whole? Now, all these things put together will be aimed towards bringing our cost of operations lower and hence a better margin. Because marketing alone is not going to be able to do that for sure.
Yeah, those are very big targets to meet, especially since last year you missed in quite a big way, Ruben. And also, I also see from the slides that distribution continues to be a challenge. Can you just talk about through the chat, why is it that distribution is such a tough part of the business? You know, because you guys have been around a long time.
See, number one, for a very simple matter, let's talk about, we've got a business in East Malaysia as well as in Singapore. If I take my East Malaysia business, freight has become expensive and it's become limited, I would call it. For us to even book our freight to East Malaysia, for example, it's a lot more complex than it was before. And notwithstanding the fact that the number of the limitations we have, both in terms of truck, warehousing, of course, now things are all getting much better now with the reopening of market. We see a bullish future ahead of us, but that really wasn't the case, I think, right up to 2-3 months ago.
So does that mean there's a possibility that these targets might not be attained, Ruben? Is that what you're telling the board? Are they still realistically expecting you to meet these numbers, given that we're already 4 months into 12?
Well, to put it that way, in our first 4 months, we're still on target. We're still on target in our first quarter. Of course,
How do you measure whether you're on target, Ruben?
No, that's against our target that we submitted to the board. So, Trump, if you look at it, we have forecasted issues that the company is going to face, all these things into our first quarter. And therefore, very frankly speaking, our target for the first quarter is, of course, lower than the coming quarters. So, as far as meeting our targets are concerned, the first quarter, we are perfectly on track. Now, whether it's going to continue for the next 3 quarters, that's something that we're actually re-looking into more.
Yeah, I also noticed that factories appear, your factories, your manufacturing, as you say, which is a big USP, they don't appear to be at full utilization. That's number one. The second thing is that you're seeking more sites for vending machines, but vending machines, I guess good locations are tough to find, and also there's still a lot of trepidation maybe that people are not going out as much as they used to be pre-pandemic. Talk through some of those challenges if you can, Ruben.
Now, factory utilization has got a lot to do with our volumes. As you aptly put it at the beginning as well, our factories produce not just for Malaysia, but also for the international markets. When I look at our condensed milk business, we export all the way up to Africa, Uzbekistan, Philippines. So we export to many other markets. Now, with the cost of goods being a challenge, with freight being a challenge, with logistics being a bit of a nightmare, it has actually become a challenge. It's put a little bit of pressure on our volumes. And with cost of products going up, we do see a little drop in volumes. Now, all these have actually contributed to our factory utilization being lower. But we do see, as I just mentioned to you just now, with things opening up, we do hope for a bullish future. I think everybody has this. And how do we then push our volumes further? Now, if I just touch on condensed milk, for example, we rely a lot on eateries. And the sheer fact that eateries are closed before 12 o'clock causes not only just the on-premise customers to lose volume, it affects manufacturers like ourselves and what we're able to sell out into the trade. Now, as far as vending machines are concerned, you're right that they are challenges, but I'll give you some sectors that are actually thriving. One example would be the industrial area, factories, where with closures, there was actually very limited options on where people could go. So that was one. So we begin to actually place more in the industrial area, and we've seen a lot of upsides there. The area where we got impacted most is public location. So frankly speaking, the transportation hubs. So we've seen some drops in these areas, but and as well as education. So transportation and education, those hubs actually took a little bit of a dip. But residential areas, factories, industrial areas, in most of these places, we actually see a jump in consumption. Now, very recently, after yesterday, we rolled out our new retail concept called the Minute Mart, which actually increased our offerings more than just beverage.
Okay. I'm talking this morning to Santha Ruben Turesundram, the chief executive of the halal beverage company Etika Group. We'll come back after this, Ruben, and talk about some ESG matters and, of course, beyond that, the larger business aspect as well. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
I'm talking this morning to Santha Ruben Turesundram, the chief executive of the halal beverage company Etika Group. Now, let's talk about ESG, Ruben. And yeah, I mean, obviously, you are trying to migrate to a more healthy future, like all drinks companies are. But condensed milk is a main staple product for you guys, and that's notoriously sweet. There are various social concerns around that point. How are you migrating away from what is essentially a Malaysian staple, where, you know, things like teh tarik is a very, very popular drink among Malaysians?
So let's break this into two. As far as our beverage business is concerned, if you see, most of our entire portfolios have already shifted to HCL. We're actually following the HCL regulation given by the government, so reducing our sugar usage on the beverage. Now, condensed milk, I would consider this quote-unquote as a raw material for the finished food. Consumers use it to prepare their teh tarik. Now, how much condensed milk the consumers use in preparation of teh tarik is something that should be controlled at the point of preparation. So trying to be totally honest with you, I mean, there is actually no... the usage of sugar in the teh tarik is determined by how the preparation is done. So that's entirely in the hands of the consumers. So that's almost like, if, you know, for sugar producers, they will continue producing sugar. But it's consumers that have to decide how much they use in their beverage.
Yeah, of course, it is a multi-party approach. But part of the problem also comes from the approach towards advertising. And in line with, you know, Asahi's, you know, 25-year megatrends report towards more ethical consumption, that is something that you have underlined within your business, which is correct and appropriate to do so. There's also concomitant guidelines towards responsible advertising and responsible marketing. Some other consumer goods companies have, you know, decided to portray their products as being healthy and good for growth, when in fact they're very, very sweet. I'm not going to name any names here. And then there's other companies, perhaps like maybe Coca-Cola, who do admit that their drinks are very sweet, but they do also then say, you know, everything in moderation. You know, Ruben, you're a marketing man, right? How do you approach advertising and marketing for what is essentially a very, very unhealthy product?
Now, so it really depends on what's your definition of an unhealthy product. Now, you find journals saying anything packaged is unhealthy, anything processed is unhealthy, anything non-organic is unhealthy, and the list goes on. Now, some of these are reality, some of these are actually perception. Now, what do we know factually is overconsumption of sugar is not healthy. Okay. Now, if you give, I just give you a little bit of an example on the how Singapore approaches it, for example. Now, they look at sweetness. They allow a certain level of sugar, but they do not allow non-nutritive sweetness, especially in schools. Now, the idea is that most beverage manufacturers, for example, or even other manufacturers, we tend to replace sugar with substitutes, stevia, for example, right? But they're non-nutritive. Now, the point is still that there is some nutrition that sugar provides. The question is how much of these do you consume? It is the overconsumption that is not good. So I guess the end responsibility lies in the hand of consumer. Now, sugar is not the only thing bad that consumers consume. There's so many other areas. Salt is another huge contributor to high blood pressure, for example. Now, there are many other areas or many other ingredients that we consume on a day-to-day basis, being Malaysian, right? So it actually finally comes down to the hands of consumer on what they consume and how much they consume. Now, to your question on advertising, less than 2% of our advertising spend is on dairy jam. Not that we think that it's not ethical to advertise dairy jam, but that's just putting some numbers to you. What we do communicate to consumers is the lifestyle aspect of these beverages and what we bring to the table. And
there is a burden of responsibility, Ruben, because although I admit that glucose is the building block of energy creation within the human body, that is indisputable. It is the volume, as you say, of how much glucose is injected into the system, and diabetes is a Malaysian malaise. It's really the messaging, and we know that big data and analytics and social media, everything is built towards specific targeted advertising on your mobile phones, on your banners, on your highway placards and what have you. Yeah, I mean, Ruben, I want to go back to the point that you're a marketing man. How do you ethically advertise what is essentially, very sweet products to not just students, not just children, but also parents as well?
So, again, the question is, what really is the definition of a very sweet product? Now, if you look at let's take the actual content of sugar in our products today. And I'm just touching that very openly, right? We are regulated. So you have an emblem on the product that says it's a healthier choice that clearly gives you a definition of how much sugar there is. So the first point is we've gone and we are in an industry that's regulated by the government. We comply with what the government regulations are, and we make it very clear to consumers on what exactly they're consuming. Now, Chuan, I would think that Tetari was a fantastic example that you gave just now, right? A larger chunk of Malaysian beverage consumption comes from hot beverages and our mama drinking culture. Now, this is an area where people consume products uninformed. They do not have an idea of how much of sugar there is in the beverage they're consuming, simply because it's left to the hands of the person preparing the beverage. And to your point, most people don't even question how much sugar is in that. Now, to touch on production ethics and responsibility, as a manufacturer, as a brand, we need to do two things. We need to follow guidelines and regulation by the government, which we do it 100%, and we need to keep consumers informed, both of which we've actually done.
This morning, I'm talking to Sundar Ruben Turesundram, the chief executive of Etika Group, the halal beverage company, and today the subsidiary of Asahi, the Japanese business conglomerate. Now, just on the subject of Asahi, Ruben, I mean, I know that you are running this business in ASEAN, and it is something which is still private, because Asahi is a listed company in Japan, but the specific market in region and in Malaysia continues to be private and accounted as such. But I'm sure that difficulties and challenges of navigating the incongruousness, I think, is a good word to describe what is essentially an alcohol company owning a halal beverage company as a parent. How do you navigate that?
Well, I think for one, we operate completely independently. Secondly, to look at, to take into account how serious Asahi as a company views the halal aspect of our business, we're the only subsidiary globally that keeps the name Etika, right? So if you look at...
Correct, but those are just names, right, Ruben? At the end of the day, it's an alcohol company owning a halal beverage company.
I think when it comes to ownership, Now, there are many alcohol companies, even in the past, and I'm not going to get into names, that own shares and stakes into other organizations. And this is actually pretty normal. The question really is not who the owner is. The question is how the company is really operating. Are we operating based on alcohol practices? Are we using certain practices that are non-halal? That's exactly not the case. Because as an example, and I just wouldn't touch on halal, you would have tobacco companies, for example, having stake in certain other companies. So it is, while Asahi is a parent company and owns our company, we do have advantages on technology, manufacturing know-how, et cetera, but we operate as a completely independent organization that is 100% certified halal.
So might this structure prove to be an impediment in the future if you choose to raise more money on the public markets?
Yes and no. Now, so to your point, assuming if we go listed, that would mean Asahi is actually releasing some part of the ownership of the company, right? So in fact, if it does happen, if it does get to that, it just, I mean, the impact of being owned 100%, or the perception of the impact of being owned by an alcohol company would technically reduce more than anything else.
And is a public listing a possibility? You know, obviously, capital is tight. It is a capital-intensive business, as you say. Distribution needs to be addressed. Factories need to be better utilized. Distribution is a challenge as well. ANP is a big issue. As you know, you are hired as an ANP man into the fold. Is that a possibility, a public issuance down the line?
With the knowledge that I have at the moment, I don't see that in the near future. But of course, Chuang, anything and everything is always a possibility. But the way Asahi has gone about acquisitions, in most markets, it's a 100% acquisition.
Okay, and just lastly, I guess, because it's a very big issue all over the world, Ruben, inflation and rising costs, your input materials, whether it's sugar, whether it's other forms of inputs, you know, what can you tell me on that front?
You see, the price of our products over the last few decades has remained pretty stable. Right? I mean, when I was a kid, a can of Pepsi was a ringgit 20. Right until a few years ago, we're still hovering around the same price, 150, 160. And if you take our Chinese beer prices, we're still about the same price. But there's only a certain point that we can actually absorb and hold costs. Now, with the rising commodity costs, what's real is that the prices of the products will increase. I think that this is true not just to us, so even our competitors, and as you can see, this price increases across the entire FMCG industry. That is, of course, the only way for us to actually recover the steep and continuous rising cost of goods and cost of raw materials.
Okay, thanks, Ruben, for your insights and, of course, for being candid in terms of your replies. I was talking to Santa Ruben Torre-Sundrum, the chief executive of the halal beverage company Etika Group, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.